House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, 2016. The first thing I want to announce, the first two items on the agenda, House Bill 4066 and House Bill 4087, are carried over to tomorrow. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4067 and call Representative Bueller, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4067 expands the whistleblower statutes to include an affirmative defense to criminal or civil charges brought about as a result of an employee's good faith disclosure of information that the employee reasonably believes showed a violation of state, federal, local, or local law, rule, or regulation. It also requires attorneys to report violations of public or nonprofit employer to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, subject to the rules of professional conduct. We currently have four amendments up on OLIS, and if at any point in time you'd like some clarification on those, I'm happy to provide.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barker, and esteemed members of the Judiciary Committee. My name for the record is Representative Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. Thank you for the opportunity to bring House Bill 4067 to you today. This would enhance protections for Oregon whistleblowers. Also, I want to take the opportunity to thank my co-sponsor, Senator Gelser and Representative Hoyle, and also a host of others who've had important input to this bill as we've moved along through the process, including the Department of Justice, Arthur Towers, and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, SEIU, and others for amendments to the bill that clarifies and I think improves it. There's a variety of amendments there, and we plan to continue working on it if possible. I draw your attention to a quick outline of what the bill does in a frequently asked question format, and so that's there for your ease of use. Let me give you a little background with regards to this legislation. It really started last session with Michael Rogers. As some of you know, Michael Rogers, it was got some attention a year ago with regards to a blowing whistle with regards to emails. When he was confronted with a difficult choice, I think he did the right decision in the face of really indifference at best and some would say intimidation at worst. He blew the whistle on potential corruption at the highest level of our government here in Oregon. His story showed that we must do more to protect Oregonians who are brave enough to stand up to what they think is right. And concerns continue about fraud and abuse in our state government. We see this expressed this session now with concerns about the controversial business energy tax credit program. So this problem is not going away. And more recently, when we weren't in session, we heard this disturbing news of fraud and abuse coming from the foster care provider, Give Us This Day. We can't stand by and hope that these types of incidents are isolated. We must be proactive in rooting out all bad actors, abusers, and lawbreakers where we find them. The state provides care and protection for some of our most vulnerable people, including foster children. We can't afford to put them at risk. Fortunately, we know there are other Oregon heroes working for the state and, for that matter, nonprofits who are willing to blow the whistle on corruption at all levels. And House Bill 4067 shows that we will stand by them and will not let their voices be silenced. More specifically, House Bill 4607 really does three things at its core. First, it increases penalties for employers who try to coerce or retaliate against whistleblowers. The second thing it does is it requires all employers under this bill to provide written whistleblower policies to their employees outlining their rights, protections, and privileges under this law. And finally, House Bill 4067 also provides an affirmative defense for whistleblowers who may turn over private documents not subject to disclosure. Importantly, if the whistleblower has reason to believe laws have been broken or evidence of mismanagement, the affirmative defense will only apply if the materials are turned over to one of the indicated sources, which includes legal counsel, law enforcement, state regulatory agencies, internal management, or even us as legislators. The intent is to provide appropriate repositories for this information rather than going to the media, which really should be an act of last resort. In closing, the bottom line of this bill will enhance penalties for those who punish or try to intimidate whistleblowers and require every public agency and nonprofit in Oregon to have whistleblower protocols in place. This will allow employees to have a safe place to turn and feel comfortable reporting possible fraud and corruption. We all win for this. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your attention.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Mueller? Representative Greenwood.
I have a question for counsel, if I may.
Okay.
What does an affirmative defense mean? I mean, the words are obvious, but what's the context of an affirmative defense?
Chair Barker, Rep. Greenlick, I'm afraid I'm not going to have a really succinct answer for you on this one, but an affirmative defense puts an, you can go in and say, this is done now, the suit stops here. You respond in a pleading and say, I have an affirmative defense to this crime, here it is laid out, motions follow, judge makes a ruling, suit is over.
That means when you have an affirmative defense, you can't be tried for it in
so
a civil affair.
I'm carrying a gun and I don't have a concealed weapons permit, and they say, we're going to arrest you, and then I can go to court and say, I'm a retired police officer, I'm covered under statute, that's an affirmative defense that I could have that gun.
Does it automatically mean the case is dismissed at that point, or does
there still needs to be motions that are done on this? It still needs to be shown that the affirmative defense does apply in this situation.
If it was credible, is my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Further questions? Thank you, Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And next we'll call Aaron Knott, Scott Winkles, and Rob Brovette, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. We are neutral on House Bill 4067 as written, though. I'd note by stating that the whistleblower mechanism and whistleblower protections have enabled many of our finest historical moments as a transparent democracy. Whistleblowers are incredibly important and have been for a very long time. That being said, there are some issues with the bill as written that we wanted to highlight, and I'll note two issues that I think will be covered elsewhere, but the Department of Justice would join. I believe you'll hear, at least from the Oregon State Bar, some concerns that the current version of the draft has the potential to interfere with attorney-client relationships and the activities of lawyers. We share those concerns, but I'll leave them to be outlined by others. Similarly, I think you'll hear testimony that this bill could have a serious impact on the ability of nonprofits to conduct their affairs. It could impose some financial and administrative burdens on them. We house the Charitable Activities Division. We're aware of the fact that some of the nonprofits in the state are four or five people working for almost no money with very little access to lawyers. But outside of noting, I'll leave it to other individuals to clarify. Where we come in on this is mostly making sure that the affirmative defense portion work the way it should. And we have a few changes we'd like to suggest. There's nothing wrong with the affirmative defense as a mechanism. As counsel indicated, it can provide you with protection if you find yourself the subject of a prosecution or a civil action. My understanding is typically how this works, and I'll note that I am far more familiar with criminal than civil, and it's not always one for one, is that you would have the burden of sort of making a production showing that this applied to you. You know, I was a whistleblower, and at that point in criminal, it would have to be disproven beyond a reasonable doubt as an affirmative defense. That's my understanding of the mechanism in very brief. First comment on Section 1. The way it's written now, it basically says that an employee's good faith, reasonable belief that a violation of law occurred will protect them from prosecution if they disclose otherwise protected information. There's nothing in there about the employer. And what that ends up meaning is that if an employee said, well, I'm going to hack into the next cubicle over because I don't like that guy, I'm going to root through his computer, and then I find evidence that he's got a codeine prescription that I don't think he's supposed to have, and I think he's coming to work intoxicated, and I release that information. That right now, which is not whistleblowing, per se, is protected by House Bill 4067. I don't believe the proponent intends for it to be. So a simple amendment to add the word employer or by the employer after violation of state, federal, state, or local law should be enough. Secondly, the standard right now for an employee making the decision to disclose is good faith, reasonable belief in the bill. Upon looking that over, the Department of Justice concluded that this is an entirely subjective standard, meaning you can have absolutely no rational basis for releasing documents and still receive the protections of the bill as long as you are experiencing it in your subjective good faith. The problem that causes is that every category of information is eligible for release here: medical records, criminal histories, juvenile adjudications. And if it doesn't line up with some larger purpose, you just have a sort of paranoid narrative about whatever it is, it would be protected. We'd like to see some insertion of an objective reasonability requirement here. Finally, on page 3, line 12, there's a prohibition against invoking or encouraging the assistance of law enforcement to discourage, restrain, dissuade, coerce, prevent, or otherwise interfere with the disclosure of whistleblower information. The problem we have with that is when you find out you're an agency manager, the head of a nonprofit, you find out that one of your employees has released a ton of information that you think is confidential or otherwise protected. You don't at this point know if they were a whistleblower, if they just took it, if it was criminal, if it was civil. This provision, the way it reads now, seems to prohibit you from calling the police and trying to get a sense of what happened. If it does turn out that the information was simply breached, it wasn't released for a whistleblowing purpose, this prohibits you from getting a law enforcement person involved that can help you preserve that scene and look at it as in terms of its potential evidentiary value later. Now, if there's an affirmative defense kicked in, you're not going to be successfully prosecuted if whistleblowing was what you were doing. So not being permitted even to call the police seems to go a step too far. And as I mentioned, I share some of the concerns of other panelists, and I'm open for any question.
Any questions? Representative Barton?
Hey, Mr. Chair, do you mind if I'll wait until the panel's
okay.
done?
Okay.
You might address it.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities certainly understands the need for whistleblower protections, and in my time working for cities, I'm aware of some instances where there have been necessary whistleblowers, and I'm aware of some instances where there probably should have been, and issues would have come to light sooner. However, we do have some concerns with 4067 as written. We would like to see, we do believe that as written, it does erode the attorney-client privilege. We want to make sure that the city attorney can have candid, confidential conversations and provide the legal advice that we would like them to do. As we read this, 4067 is introduced, our general counsel, for instance, provides ethics trainings around the state. And so if someone asks a question in an ethics training, then where there might be a potential violation, then his obligation would be to report. And I don't think we want to do that. I think what we want are people to be able to go to the attorney with some confidence that it's a confidential conversation, let that person keep them from things from getting out of hand, or to provide them the necessary advice. And so that is a concern. Additionally, we do believe that the affirmative defense should apply to lawfully obtained materials. So someone cannot illegally obtain materials in a scenario, in the detailed scenario Mr. Knott outlined, and receive an affirmative defense. Looking at the dash fives, I think we're getting very close to something. I understand there are some panelists and stakeholders that have additional concerns over the dash fives, and conversations will be ongoing, and we will look forward to participating in those constructively. But we do understand the intent of the bill, and we would like to see this resolved.
Thank you.
For the record, Rob Ovette, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties, ditto. Look forward to working with the sponsors of this bill, maybe some combination of dash 1, dash 5, and dash 6, put in a blender and come out and spread right, might work out. But look forward maybe over the next 24, 48 hours bringing you a dash amendment that will take care of these concerns and make sure we don't compromise the attorney-client privilege.
Any questions? Okay, now you have a question. Okay. Questions? Okay, thank you, panel. Helen Hirschbeld. Hirschbeld, I'm sorry. And bad carbon copy. And Jim White. You go in any order, please remember to identify yourself for the record when you go.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Helen Hirschbeld. I had to look down. I'm executive director for the Oregon State Bar. I used to be general counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors regarding House Bill 4067. The Oregon State Bar opposes House Bill 4067 as written, but has been working with LC's office to propose some amendments, and the current form is the amendment, the -5 amendments that have been submitted to the committee, and I'll talk about those in a minute. First, why we're here. The Oregon State Bar is an instrumentality of the Judicial Department of the Judicial Branch of the State of Oregon, and we are charged with the regulation of lawyers in Oregon, including disciplining lawyers for violation of the rules of professional conduct that are adopted by the Oregon Supreme Court. And the bar has concerns that House Bill 4067, as written, conflicts with the bar's responsibility to carry out those regulatory functions and erodes the lawyer's duty of confidentiality as set forth in the rules of professional conduct. So the rules of professional conduct require that lawyers protect their clients' confidential information. And confidential information includes information that is subject to the attorney-client privilege, and it also includes all other information that's gained during the course of representing a client that would be detrimental or embarrassing to the client if disclosed, or that the client has asked you to keep secret. And the Oregon Supreme Court has noted that a lawyer's duty to protect clients' confidential information lies at the very heart of the lawyer-client relationship. The lawyer's promise to maintain confidentiality engenders the client's trust in the lawyer, which then in turn ensures that the client will fully and frankly discuss the client's concerns with the lawyer, even embarrassing or damaging matters, so the client can share that information, so that the lawyer can then in turn provide information and advice about how the client can proceed and comply with the law. So the amendments as proposed would, we believe, would help protect that duty of confidentiality. The first proposed amendment, Section 1, Subsection 1, would be to insert lawfully obtained. I believe one of the other gentlemen already talked about that. We don't want to encourage employees, I don't think, to engage in unlawful conduct in order to acquire information they'll be disclosing to law enforcement. We don't want to incentivize bad behavior, thus the proposal to insert lawfully obtained. In Section 3 of the -5 amendment, the new language would make clear that the affirmative defense does not apply to the lawyer employee or to those non-lawyer employees who are working directly with the lawyer. And by those lawyer employees, we're talking about the lawyer employees who are providing legal advice and representation to their client. And the reason that we've included the non-lawyer employees, the reasoning there is that lawyers invariably work with non-lawyers to provide legal advice and assistance, and they're required by the rules of professional conduct to ensure that their assistants, their non-lawyer assistants, also bring their conduct into conformance with the rules of professional conduct, that they also protect clients' confidentiality. And so if they are given that affirmative defense, they can erode that confidentiality by acting outside the scope of the rules of professional conduct. Section 4, this is a section that I think needs more work. We need to clarify with LC's office and would like the opportunity to continue to work with them on that particular section. Section 5 of the Dash 5 amendments specifically provides that any information that is disclosed, that if it's disclosed, it doesn't act as a waiver of attorney-client privilege. There's been some talk about whether that is really a necessary amendment, because typically if a privilege is owned by the client, so the only person who has the authority to waive privilege is the client or the client's agent. So if the information is leaked by somebody other than the client, then normally that wouldn't act as a waiver, but we want to make darn sure that there is no waiver if that happens. So that's the purpose of the subsection 5. And I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, Mr. White, why don't you go ahead and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Esteemed representatives, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. For the record, my name is Jim White. I'm the executive director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. We are the state association of nonprofits here in Oregon. We represent 1,100 of the 17,000 501c3 charitable benefit organizations that we are lucky enough to have in our state that serve all of our communities. We have concerns with HB 4067 as currently drafted. I will admit that the last version I saw of this was Amendment 1, so we've moved very quickly through the day. The issues that we have with the bill as it's currently drafted is that we believe it's redundant for the nonprofit portions of it relative to existing whistleblower regulations that are in place and generally accepted and understood by nonprofits that cover these proposed purposes within the legislation. The American Bar Association, and I hope you'll back me up on this, states that although most provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley apply only to public companies, at least two criminal provisions apply to nonprofit organizations. Those provisions prohibiting retaliation against whistleblowers and prohibiting the destruction of or alteration or concealment of certain documents or the impediment of investigations. So we know that already Sarbanes-Oxley Act 1107 makes it a crime, and I can read this to you, to, quote, knowingly take action harmful to a person with the intent to retaliate against that person for providing a law enforcement officer with truthful information relating to the commission or possible commission of any offense. So we believe that the nonprofit portion of this bill, which is what we're concerned about, doesn't really follow existing regulations that are already in place. Additionally, IRS Form 990, which charitable benefit nonprofits are required to fill out if they are above a certain size, and those sizes would generally coincide with those organizations which would be staffed, because there are many nonprofits who are not staffed or staffed to such a small number that having a whistleblower policy of this magnitude would be very difficult for them to put into place. But in the Form 990 Part 4 Section B called Policies, Question 13 expressly asks, did the organization have a written whistleblower policy? We believe that that question has been widely credited with the acceleration of the adoption of whistleblower policies throughout the nonprofit community. Creating new avenues for reporting beyond regulators and law enforcement to include members of the legislative assembly would also create a confusing system that would cause nonprofits to potentially run afoul of the law inadvertently. Another concern we have with the bill as drafted is that the legislation treats charitable nonprofit employees as public entities, which we believe impinges on nonprofit independence. The Oregon Revised Statutes generally regulate public, private, and nonprofit sectors separately, taking into account their distinct characteristics and differences. The proposed legislation extends current whistleblower protections, which are designed to cover public employees, to the employees of every 501c3, regardless of any connection to government contracts or grants. Nonprofits are not public sector entities and should not be treated as such in statute. Also, in a departure from current practice, HB 4067 does not extend the same burden to create the or regulate policies to other categories of nonprofits, of which there are an additional 19. So this is specifically pointing only 501c3s, or to for-profit employers, except those that contract with the state. If enacted, the law would impose unequal burdens on charitable nonprofit employers dedicated to the common good. Finally, the legislation we believe is unnecessary. The nonprofit community is already committed to promoting ethical practices, including adoption and utilization of whistleblower policies. NAO believes that other means by which whistleblower policies can be put in place are being employed, and that nonprofits can be can use those to both ensure the protection of those employees who choose to be a whistleblower, but also to protect their and assure their rights. We have been, NAO has been working as the Oregon dissemination partner for the independent sectors, Principles for Good Governance and Ethical Practice, which I have a copy of here, which is quite an extensive 33 different principles that we have asked nonprofits to use and follow. Principle four in this is that a charitable organization should adopt and implement policies and procedures that enable individuals to come forward with information on illegal practices or violations of organizational policies. This whistleblower policy should specify the organization will not retaliate against and will seek to protect the confidentiality of individuals who make good faith reports. So in closing, we believe that organizations like Independent Sector, the National Council of Nonprofits, we support their contention that reasonability and non-burdensome regulations and policies that already make the nonprofit community the most transparent sector of the U.S. economy, and an appropriate balance has to be struck with and recognizes and respects the independent activities of nonprofits as public-spirited yet still private organizations. So for those reasons, at this point, we have to put forward our objections to 4067.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Representative Greenlick, you have a question?
I'd like to understand the bar's position better on this. Is the worry that a lawyer might use whistleblower protection to disclose privileged information? Is that the concern?
That's Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, yes, that's exactly the issue.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Helen, a question for you. With respect to public sector lawyers, mm-hmm. nonprofit, my question doesn't really apply to that as much. I should note that I think perhaps your concerns, and indeed my question about them, might be moot, because my understanding is at least that portion is coming out of this bill. I'm not sure. But I know Representative Bueller and Mr. Conger are working very hard to try and refine their bill so that they can pass it this session. If anyone can do it, it's them, but we'll see if they run out of time. I am pulling for them, though. But so even if it comes out this session, the component about attorney-client privilege concerns, I suspect that this issue might come up again in future sessions. And so, but I'm just wondering, given that, in essence, the public agencies belong to us, all of us. They belong to the people of Oregon. And the DOJ, anyway, at least represents not just the agency, it really represents the people of Oregon and the guise of that agency. Isn't it entirely appropriate for us, on behalf of the people of Oregon, as signed by the governor as well, legislature and governor signing this bill, to kind of prospectively waive our privilege, then not the agency, but we, the people, own, with respect to prescribed or criminal conduct? That makes sense?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, it sounds like the question relates to whether it's a good policy for the people to prospectively waive the privilege on behalf of the entire state. I'm not sure I'm prepared to speak to that particular policy here today. I will say that the privilege is long-standing and hardly and defended heartily, even for the state, for the same reason that it is defended for individuals, which is that even the state wants to try and ensure that its conduct is in conformance with the rules of professional conduct without having its dirty laundry aired in the process necessarily. So I think it's a good question, and I think that it's something that, if considered, I would hope that this committee and that the legislative body would very carefully consider before doing it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Arthur Towers and Dana Sullivan.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
And my name is Dana Sullivan. And I'll kick us off. I'm an employment lawyer. I've been representing individuals in employment-related disputes for 20-plus years, and about 30% of my practice, if not more, is involved in the representation of whistleblowers. And so I want to thank you on behalf of my clients for considering this tremendously important issue today. HB 4067 proposes a critical complement to the existing protections for whistleblowers. While true that whistleblowers are now able to pursue a claim if they're discharged for their whistleblowing activity, I can tell you from a handful that I've cases that I've been involved in the last 2 to 5 years, that more and more we're seeing that employers whose wrongdoing is brought to light adopt the approach that the best defense is a good offense. And so I can tell you that a frequent tactic by employers who are sued for retaliatory discharge by a whistleblower will pursue counterclaims against that employee seeking significant monetary damages based on the conduct underlying the whistleblowing. And that is certainly a deterrent for the employees to raise the issues in the first place. I've counseled a number of whistleblowers who have opted not to pursue litigation for the very reason that they were concerned about exposing themselves to liability by the employer. And so I think we all share the goal of having wrongdoing brought to light. The individuals who in most instances are most knowledgeable about the wrongdoing are going to be employees who not only are fearful about losing their jobs, but are also fearful, I can tell you from my own practice, about exposing themselves to liability from an aggressive employer defense tactic. And so this is a very important protection. And we understand that the bar has concerns about the attorney-client privilege issues. I'm confident we can resolve those issues, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Any questions? Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. I think that this is really important, and I think that the idea of trying to help people come forward exposing wrongdoing and not be dissuaded by risk of themselves being attacked is really important. What alterations would you propose to meet the concerns that the bar has brought forward and that some of the other folks who are going to testify have brought forward and help accomplish that? Because I think it would be a great thing if there were a solution.
Chair Barker, Representative Leininger, we're in the process of hashing out that wording. I feel that in my last conversation with the bar, I felt that we were pretty close, and so I feel like getting that all hashed worked out is plausible. I think that the big issues that we want to make sure that we preserve, in addition to what Ms. Sullivan testified to, are that both internal and external disclosure are protected, because so many times a whistleblower will start by going to a manager or the manager's manager, and we want to make sure that that person has protections, as does the person who goes outside first or to an attorney first. We do feel the attorney-client privilege is sacrosanct, but it's we want to, again, figure out a nuanced way to tackle this, and I'm confident that we can. The other issue that has come up is the legally obtained information. And I want to draw a little bit of a distinction. It might be between legally accessed and legally obtained. If a care provider, for example, in a nonprofit has access to information about a person's caregiving regimen and has direct knowledge that that caregiving regimen is not being followed, we want to make sure that that person has the protection that they can come forward to blow the whistle on negligent action, bad actions by the facility. So that's the internal and external issue, the lawfully accessed versus lawfully obtained. Those are a couple of places that we're looking at. But we do feel in general that this issue is important enough to put some time and effort into it over the course of the next couple of days to see if we can't bring forward a product that's worthwhile. So my apologies for answering your question and testifying too, but thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony.
Can I just add one last point?
Sure.
And that is that I am thrilled that the nonprofit sector is covered by this. Many of you are familiar with my previous employment, and there, one of the main reasons the workers wanted to come forward to join a union was over this very set of issues, that there be some sort of protection so that when they see things going wrong in terms of quality of care, they could speak up, again, in the nonprofit setting. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I know Representative Bueller has been trying to work with everybody to get the amendments done, and we appreciate his effort on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll carry over the work session on the bill. Next item on the agenda, we're going to jump up to House Bill 4013. Probably open a public hearing.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4013 is the product of the Oregon Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group, as well as good Judge Tennyson from Multnomah County, who brought this to our attention as a possible update for the short 2016 session. It would allow counties to establish multidisciplinary fatality review teams for fatalities that involve abuse or neglect of elderly or vulnerable adults. Now, we have these teams already for examinations of deaths from child abuse and domestic violence. This would allow them to take place in the cases of elder abuse or neglect of elders or vulnerable adults. It also establishes a statewide fatality review team within the Department of Human Services. That statewide team is to gather information from the county teams, identify trends in abuse, and make recommendations and take specific actions on statewide issues, as well as conduct reviews of fatalities in jurisdictions that elect not to establish a local team. We have the proposed -1 and the proposed -2 amendments today. Both of them update the definition of neglect and redefine the definition of person with a disability. They add membership to the local and statewide teams. They require a report to the legislature no later than September 15th of each year with a recommendation for improvement in rules and local actions and legislation if that's appropriate.
Okay. Call Ellen Klein, Wendy Hillman, and Cheryl Ramirez. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Ellen Klem. I'm the Director of Consumer Outreach and Education for the Oregon Attorney General. As many of you know, the prevention of elder abuse is a high priority for the Attorney General. Unfortunately, despite our best efforts, the justice, health, and social service system's response to elder abuse lags far behind the responses to child abuse and domestic violence. Fatality review teams for child abuse and domestic violence have improved system responses to the victims. This bill, 4013, with the -1 amendments, and I'm going to pause here because I just now understand they came through with the -2, and I haven't seen those amendments yet. So the testimony I'm presenting here today assumes nothing about that amendment. So with the Dash 1 amendments would improve the response for elder abuse victims by allowing the state and local governing bodies to create their own elder abuse fatality review teams. The Dash 1 amendments would house the statewide team at the Oregon Department of Justice, an agency appropriately staffed and trained to serve this function. The work of the teams will help policymakers, program administrators, and the public spot gaps in the system, and through the identification of local, regional, and statewide trends, prioritize protections and reforms to prevent future deaths attributed to elder abuse. The existence of these teams sends the clear message that elder abuse is taken just as seriously as domestic violence and child abuse. I urge you to support House Bill 4013 as modified by the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, representing the community mental health programs and the community developmental disabilities programs across the state. We support the concept of a fatality review team for elderly and vulnerable adults. We do have a few suggestions about this bill. First, we would advocate for using existing models and processes for fatality reporting and in conjunction with abuse investigations. For example, the county multidisciplinary teams, the child fatality review team model, and the DD system fatality reporting process. We're concerned that especially in smaller counties, a lot of the same team members will be across all of these teams. There's just not enough people to staff all of these teams in the smaller counties. And also, I think there's some good administrative processes already set up in these other team models. Secondly, concerning information sharing, we would suggest designating one of the team members as a records coordinator who is HIPAA compliant and trained. And then one last comment is that if the investigation involves a person with a substance use disorder, the team may run into a barrier with 42 CFR Part 2, which, as you may know, the federal government is considering modernizing, but it's not implemented yet. And our concern is that this would make a conflict with the community mental health programs, who would not be allowed to share all of the information that might be needed in this particular case. I have a longer written testimony with more details, and thank you for letting me share these comments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee members. Thank you for your time. I hope your day is going well. I'm Wendy Hillman, the manager of the Adult Protective Services Program for Multnomah County Aging, Disability, and Veteran Services. And Multnomah County is asking that you pass House Bill 4013 and include the Dash 1 amendment. And I also I'm not familiar with the second amendment, the Dash 2 amendment. In 2014, there were over 38,000 reports of abuse and neglect of elders and vulnerable adults in Oregon. This is a 10% increase over the previous year, and that trend is predicted to continue as Oregonians are living longer. But the research indicates that the abuse of elders and vulnerable adults can hasten death. Fatality review teams in both child abuse and domestic violence have improved service collaboration and early intervention. An elder and vulnerable adult fatality review team brings together professionals to examine deaths that may have resulted from abuse or neglect and to evaluate the service gaps and improve cooperation to prevent similar deaths in the future. Multnomah County has a history of strong coordination among human services, law enforcement, and justice partners. We believe the addition of an elderly and vulnerable adult fatality review team will significantly expand our efforts to address and prevent future abuse. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for you guys. If for any reason you don't feel you don't want to answer it, that's no problem. And hopefully then the next panel will do it, because it's not specific to any one of you guys. But I remember the previous bill we heard is trying to kind of expand information and protections for whistleblowers. And while I certainly get the intent of this bill, it seems that it probably would do the exact opposite, i.e. there's some confidentiality provisions, if you look at page 3 of the bill, and maybe it's removed in the amendments, and also it's incorporated in the last line of the bill for the statewide, it seems that it creates an extreme privilege. And for example, the previous, I believe the bar testified that the attorney-client privilege is sacrosanct. Well, yes and no. Actually, it's subject to a series of exceptions. There are no exceptions to this confidentiality provision. It seems like it might, in essence, hide information that is in the public interest forever in a black box.
Representative Barker and Representative Barton, I can attempt to answer that. I think the purpose of the confidentiality in these discussions is so that everybody can talk openly and frankly about maybe what went wrong or what went right with their agency and identify gaps. The cases that we'd be reviewing would be long past the statute of limitations. So I think that's important to keep in mind, too. I don't know if anybody on the panel has anything else to add or any of the additional testimony may be helpful to you, but that would just be sort of my summary about the intent of the bill in terms of the confidentiality provisions. One more point. There will be a report you can see, I think, in the First Amendment. I don't know if it's also in the Second Amendment, but there is a report that would be issued to the legislature every year that would talk about what the fatality review team found. Certain information, of course, would be redacted from that, and then make recommendations, including spotting of trends, et cetera. So I think those are important things to keep in mind as we're thinking about why this bill is so important.
May I follow up?
Yes, please.
I appreciate that, and I really do. I'm obviously sympathetic to the intent of this. But I just want to push back on that, because this, as written, is so broad that it really does. It's like a black hole that nothing can ever escape from. And there might be many situations. For example, let's pretend many public entities themselves provide care. Pretend for a moment that there was, a pattern of misconduct in a public entity. That would be information in the public interest that we think we would have, and that could never be disclosed. Other exigent circumstances. You could think of all sorts of potential hypotheticals. Anyway, I just have some concerns that perhaps those possible circumstances are not accounted for in this bill.
Representative Barker, Representative Barton, I think those are valid concerns, but I think when you think about the individuals that are all at the table and those of us who work in this field and are very passionate about protecting the lives of older adults, I don't necessarily envision any scenario in which that's going to happen, in which any of us are going to attempt to hide the ball, per se. We all care very strongly about these older adults, and the purpose of these teams is to protect them and continue to protect them. And if that means that we have to make sweeping changes at an agency that has been hiding the ball for years, then I think that's what all of us on the team hopefully would be prepared to do.
Representative Greenlight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've looked at other bills that define people over 65 as vulnerable. You seem to differentiate elderly and vulnerable, which I think is an improvement over definitions. But what makes a person 65 more vulnerable than a person 64? Or a person 67? I mean, for somebody who's 80. And that looks like a bunch of youngsters that you're doing.
Perspective is important. Chair Barker and Representative Greenlee, we were trying to expand on the recognizing that vulnerability is actually probably more significant than age in this situation. We wanted to be able to. I'm speaking as if I wrote this. I didn't. But as we look at this, we want to be able to look at people who were victims of abuse and neglect, where they were perhaps dependent upon others for care. And so the expanded definition is to broaden the scope of people that we might, whose deaths we might examine.
Can I follow?
Did I answer your question?
Well, let me ask the next question. It is true that people, as they age, become more, it becomes more probable that they're vulnerable. But I wonder why you need to put age in. I mean, if somebody is 55 and vulnerable, I think you want to talk to that. If somebody's 73 and vulnerable, you want to talk to that. It's not the age that's the issue, I think. It's the vulnerability that's the issue.
You make a very good point.
But we're putting in statute age at this point.
Mm-hmm. We put, Representative, we put that in the past. In, there were some financial abuse bills. We put age 65 in there.
In other statutes, there are statutes that define a vulnerable person as somebody over 65. This, I think, is an improvement in that it doesn't quite do that. It talks about age and vulnerability as two different factors. I think that's an advantage, but I wonder why age when the issue is vulnerability and not age.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Barker,
yes.
Representative Greenlink, I just wanted to address that from my vantage point. I was speaking on behalf of people with developmental disabilities and mental illness. So some of them may be older, but I really was speaking from the vantage point of people with disabilities, the people we represent. So I wasn't really looking at someone being older and that was it. You know, that was the only, they might be older and have developmental disabilities or mental illness. So that's how I was framing my comments.
On page one, it defines among elderly and vulnerable a person 65 years of age. And then it goes into vulnerability categories, which makes sense to me. It's the age part that doesn't make sense. Anyway, I feel compelled to raise this point when I see it.
Yeah.
I knew that
65 is the...
I was waiting for it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
I call Judge Tennyson next, please. And Representative Gilliam, would you like to come up as well? Or? Okay. And that's just questions. Okay, thank you.
I would appreciate it, Representative Gilliam, because you know I'm always nervous about this. This is a turnabout thing for me because as a circuit court judge, I'm always looking at people to talk. And now you're looking at me. So in any event, my name is Catherine Tennyson. I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County. I just want to make it clear I'm here on behalf of my own personal opinion and not the representing the Oregon Judicial Department today. I'm here to support House Bill 4013 because I believe it provides yet another brace in the scaffolding that is designed to hold up vulnerable adults in our community. I'm recalling the only other time I've ever testified before a legislative committee, and that was this committee in 2014 when I was asking you to support a change in the guardianship statutes that provided clear authority for judges to appoint trained volunteers to visit with guardians and protected people under guardianships with the sole purpose of providing independent information to the court about how things were going after the guardianship had been established. We needed to have independent verification of the health and the welfare of those people because we had no other mechanism for doing that. That provision was also a change designed to prevent abuse. And I want you to know that in the last year, since that has been effective and we've had a full year of guardianship monitoring provided by guardian partners with trained volunteers. We've had 26 volunteer monitors. We've been able to monitor 5% of our guardianship cases in Multnomah County, in other words, 72 cases of those cases. There have been a change of the guardians in 8% of the cases monitored. That's 6 people who weren't being well served by the guardians that they had. But here's the other thing that happened that I think is really interesting, and I never would have expected it. 5 of those cases, 7% of the cases monitored, were resulted in a termination of the guardianship because the guardianship was no longer needed. Now, if you had asked me 2 years ago, I would have said I wanted to make sure that everybody was okay. I would never have thought restoration of their civil rights would be the result of this monitoring program, and in fact, that's what we're finding, and I'm delighted to tell you about that today. When I was here 2 years ago, I told you that I would come back when I thought there was another thing that we could do to help prevent abuse in our communities of vulnerable adults. And this fatality, the vulnerable adult fatality review concept is just such a thing. I know it seems heartless, that what we would be doing is taking a tragedy apart to be able to understand how to prevent it. But really, that's how we learn. Virtually every piece of a building code related to fire safety and advances in aviation safety came from a searching inquiry about how the accident occurred or how the event occurred that caused death. Fatality review teams are well-known quantities in the area of child deaths and domestic violence, and in fact, the confidentiality provisions in this bill are no different than the fatality review confidentiality provisions in the child and domestic violence fatality review situation. So it's not adding anything. It's just providing us with the ability to have frank conversations with each other about what happened, how it happened, and what we can do to fix it in the future in order to clearly identify methods to help prevent tragedies from occurring. And I will say, having participated in one that we were able to do using the domestic violence fatality review statutory construct, because we were reviewing a murder-suicide, what we really found was that the services and issues or things that are available that are to, in the community to assist people are so very different for people who are in their years where they need assistance, and that's not everyone. Representative Greenlick, certainly. There are lots of hardy 95-year-olds that I see in my courthouse every day. But what we found was that we needed to have a different set of services available in the community to assist people who needed it. You cannot send an 85-year-old person to a domestic violence shelter designed for women and children. It doesn't work. So what we need to be able to do is have, as I said, searching, frank conversations with each other about how abuse and neglect occurs for vulnerable adults in our community. And this bill provides us with the construct to be able to do that. And I hope that you support it. Be glad to answer any questions that anyone has.
Any questions? Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony today. And Art Towers, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm exceedingly proud of our members who fight for vulnerable Oregonians who are victimized by elder abuse. We have a number of members who do that, just as we have a number of members who protect whistleblowers, as we heard earlier today. We also had concerns regarding Section 11 of the legislation. I would think in many respects this is on the right, the overall bill is on the right track. I don't want to question the motivation or integrity of the people involved in these investigations. A previous witness talked about the compassion and professionalism that they bring to the task at hand, and I believe that to be the case. It takes a special person to dig into these things and watch out for people who have been victimized in this way, and I applaud their efforts and appreciate them. The dilemma is the, as I read Section 11, it doesn't provide much leeway to them. It says that the information, like on line 16, the list of things are confidential. Line 17 and 18, the document is confidential. The records are confidential, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's not a lot of latitude there to committee members. And so we were very nervous about this, because one of the ways that abusers are held accountable is through the civil justice system. And this sort of information is important to have to shed light on. I'll conclude my remarks and be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Towers? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll be carrying the work session over on House Bill 4013. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4074.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, this is House Bill 4074, and it is brought to us today by the committee. We do not yet have the fiscal or revenue impact statements. House Bill 4074 does several things. To begin with, this bill comes as a result of legislation passed in the 2015 session That was House Bill 2320. That measure provided a hearing on the issue of reporting as a sex offender for juveniles found to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. The previous measure amended ORS 163A.025, which governs reporting requirements to apply to juveniles who had been ordered to report following a hearing. An unforeseen consequence of this latter provision is that it negated the registration requirements for juveniles adjudicated before August 12, 2015. That was the effective date of House Bill 2320. House Bill 4074 corrects this error and also addresses procedural issues related to those hearings. Additionally, the current law provides a provision that any other person allowed by the court may inspect and or copy juvenile court files. This was added in 2013 in Senate Bill 622 and goes into effect this summer. House Bill 4074 is an attempt to provide clarity on what and guidance to the court on who is entitled to records under this any other person allowed by the court. So to begin with, it first adds that any other person, it adds in addition other entities, and that these other persons or entities must file a motion requesting inspection or copying of the juvenile court file. The motion must include an affidavit explaining why inspection or copying is needed. And it also requires that if the court determines that the requesting party has met certain requirements, that the court must conduct an in-camera review before releasing any of the records. There is a Dash 1 amendment, which just came out a couple of hours ago. This amendment pertains mostly to the registration parts of the bill by creating a fourth group within this requirement. This fourth group applies to individuals who are adjudicated before August 12, 2015, but that on that date were still under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court or the PSRB. But as of the effective date of this act, are no longer under the jurisdiction. This new group would be required to report as a sex offender within 120 days if they had never made their initial report, or if they had made their initial reports already, then they would be required to continue to report as normal. It goes on to give them the right to a hearing on the issue of reporting, and that this hearing must, their notice of this right to a hearing must occur within 90 days, and that the person then has 120 days to request this hearing, and it sets forth the requirements of the hearing. It also adds a section that a person who fails to appear at these hearings on the issue of registration, then the court has authority to require them to register if they fail to report or fail to appear at the hearing. Finally, it applies some conforming and clarifying language, such as that the Oregon Youth Authority is allowed to register juveniles, and that parents whose rights have been terminated are allowed to obtain a copy of the judgment terminating their parental rights under the record section of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Cody Hack, Judge McKnight, and Laura Hansel, please. Please go ahead and in any order identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Cody Hack. I'm a second year law student at Willamette University College of Law. And I'm currently externing the Oregon Law Commission. It's been an excellent opportunity for me to learn more about the legislative process. And after graduation, I hope to get involved with criminal law or consumer law. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Oregon Law Commission, the neutral, nonpartisan law reform body for the state of Oregon, and it's existed by statute since 1997. It is currently housed at Willamette University College of Law. I will be briefly outlining the history of House Bill 4074, and Judge McKnight and Deputy Director Laura Hansel will be going through the substance of the bill. As the Juvenile Court Records Work Group was established to address issues of clarity and remove contradictions in the juvenile codes in preparation for the launch of eCourt. And the work group has previously submitted three bills designed to address access to court records. With the help and input of over 30 juvenile court judges, the work group created a balance which allows open access to juvenile court records while also providing guidance to the judiciary. The commission's portion of House Bill 4074 addresses a diverse group of interests. It's a good bill, and I respectfully request you adopt the commission's forthcoming amendments and move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, I should say, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maureen McKnight. I'm the Chief Family Court Judge in Multnomah County, but I'm here today as a member of the Oregon Law Commission Work Group on Juvenile Court Records. My role here today is really to address the any other person allowed by the court language that Mr. Hack referred to. This really has to do with the extent of the court's authority to allow access to juvenile court records to individuals who are not specifically named in statute by virtue of their connection to the case. I wanted to begin by, first of all, expressing my appreciation for two things. First is listening to two Multnomah County judges in one afternoon. I appreciate that. My colleague, Judge Tennyson, was here earlier. But also to thank you for your patience in allowing the commission work group to take three full legislative sessions to do the work that it needed to do on this issue. There has been what I deem placeholder language in effect, in essence, since the 2003 session, the any other person allowed by the court. And that placeholder and the serial deferred operative dates in the 2013, 14, and 15 sessions were necessitated by the fact that in 2013, trial court litigation arose about this exact issue, and several work group members had to recuse themselves. That trial litigation was followed by an appeal, which was followed by a mandamus. And the resolution of that trial court litigation didn't happen with the speed that would have allowed us to have the fully informed discussion in the work group that we needed really up to the year 2015. So the work group did spend much of 2015 talking about not just the policies that statutorily favor confidentiality, but the fact that we have a state constitutional provision for open courts. None of the litigation, either trial level or appellate, well, I should say none of the appellate litigation resulted in an opinion, so we did not have appellate guidance in discussing this at the Law Commission. But what we had was, in addition to the work group, a group of about 30 juvenile court judges who were meeting at a statewide conference this past August. And knowing that the work group was meeting and knowing the importance of this issue, we spent some time discussing what approach we as juvenile court judges felt was appropriate given the statutory confidentiality and as yet undefined contours of the state constitutional provision. We know some things from what the appellate courts have decided about what open courts means, but not everything has been articulated, and most particularly not in light of what has been recognized as potential protections that would be possibly recognized for vulnerable children in juvenile court. But the consensus of those 30 plus, it's about 33 judges, I think, in August was that we felt that rather than having the wide open discretion that the any other person language afforded, was to actually adopt an approach that had criteria and rigor and a procedure. And that was the recommendation that those judges made to the Law Commission work group. And that was the general approach that the work group took, though we obviously spent hours talking about who would have interests in both a dependency and abuse neglect case, as well as a delinquency, even a status offense type of case for runaways, and really trying to flesh out what that procedure would look like. And we did look at statutes from other jurisdictions who don't have our constitutional protections. What the work group did recommend is spelled out on, I don't have the amended one, I have the introduced bill.
You have section 9.
Okay, it's in section 9 on page 18 of the bill. And the process is not a complicated one that the work group came up with, but it is detailed in order to ensure that anyone who might have an interest that is outside those parties connected to the case, someone else comes in saying, gee, I want to get access to this particular juvenile court record or the audio recording or, you know, some aspect of the case, to make sure that that was addressed. And Section 9 does detail the procedure. First of all, we are in the bill recommending that there be a written motion. In a county as big as ours, for example, we probably anticipate having a form for that. And there are ways to make such types of forms available to other courts. But the movement for the access would need to detail why that inspection or copying would be sought. If the need for access was related to anything going on in that juvenile case, or if it was entirely separate, and how the access for that particular person would serve the various factors and criteria that the court had to balance, which I'll get to later on. So the process would really involve 14 days notice to all of the named parties in the case. You know, the parents, there could be a court-appointed special advocate, it could be the district attorney, could be the attorney general, it could be the Department of Community Justice, probation if there were a delinquency case, could be tribes, there could be a fair number of parties involved in addition to the children. If a party doesn't know who a particular party is or have an address, then it would be the court's obligation to send out notice saying you have 14 days to object to the last known address that the court had for that person. The court would be able to increase that time frame or shorten it as the nature of the request might dictate. And a hearing would not necessarily be required. It could occur, but whether there was a hearing or not, the court would be required to review the records in camera to make sure the court had looked at the records at stake and to read the responses that any party had filed, including objections, to make a determination. And what we identified really as the interest at stake were the privacy and particular vulnerabilities of that child or youth, plus their family members that could be involved, interest of other parties to the case, victims in the case, and what the interest was of the person who was making the request for access, and specific recognition of the right of the public on having interest in this proceeding. So the upshot was that the court was to consider all of these interests, and in a particular case, one or more might preponderate, but we didn't want to emphasize or detail what that weighing would be because it would be driven by the individual facts in the case. We did recommend, which is what the bill proposes, that a court allow the access as necessary to serve that need if the court found it legitimate. Required that we make protective orders if we did allow access, but give us discretion as to the timing of release and also what would be copied, what would be inspected, and around those parameters. There's obviously no guarantee this would pass constitutional muster, but it is the best thinking of both the work group, and it's the approach that the juvenile court judges endorsed as a way to try to address really what are competing interests, but in light of, as I say, an as yet undefined in some specifics right of the public to open courts. There were three other sort of minor issues that were implicated by our work on this any other person language. And that was first to clarify that if a person's status as the lawyer for someone or whatever status they had under the categorical right, that is that person has a connection to the case, they're not this third person coming in under the I have a motion, I'm not connected to the case, but I want access. If you're connected to the case because of your role there, you don't lose that statutory access because the court terminated its power over the child or you were no longer, basically because the court case was closed, in essence. It's sort of once a party, always a party for getting that access. And the second piece did clarify that if you were a parent whose rights were terminated, your access rights ended when your rights were terminated. And it also clarified what is really current practice, that when the court is releasing documents, that it is not required to redact out information that regards or that pertains to other siblings. That's pretty much the practice of the court right now. And this provision really does clarify that. So in sum, I guess, we're suggesting that an approach that statutorily recognizes the public's right to know as well as the panoply of other interests and leaves to the judge the mandated consideration of all of those interests and making an individual determination in that case, recognizing that we would still be able to set parameters if access is allowed. But we really did spend considerable time, and I think this represents probably a very representative view of all of the stakeholders who were at the work group, in addition, as I say, to the judges. So I'll turn it over to Laura right now, who will talk about some other issues, and unless there were questions right now.
Well, go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Laura Hansel, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. So I just wanted to spend a few moments going over the amendments we've proposed to this bill. They're part of the Dash 1 amendment that was posted around 312. So I think the best way to talk about this is to reference the current bill. And I referenced a lot of these changes. I've spoken with you individually and also during our January informational. But first off is a provision specifically for the Office of Public Defense Services. We've also come up with a provision specifically for the Oregon State Bar. So to talk about them together, both of these organizations play very important roles for the public that we wanted to make sure that they were not hindered in carrying out, and again, weighing the balance of protecting sensitive juvenile court records, but also allowing access to those that need it to get the work done that they need. So just to give you an example, the Office of Public Defense Services processes 170,000 case claims a year. That comes out to 3,270 a week. So they'd like a provision that they can point to quickly and say, this is where we get access, this is how, because if they were denied access perhaps even a day, that could have some serious consequences. Similarly, for the Oregon State Bar, currently, if they need to investigate an attorney, and I should clarify for OPDS, they're doing auditing and investigatory work as well. They currently, even to get most basic information, have to file a motion with the court. This clearly is not efficient and takes up a lot of the court's time and resources. So we wanted to make sure we could get a provision as well for the Oregon State Bar. And as you may recall, there was a federal issue involved with this. We needed to make sure that under Title 4E of the Social Security Act that we maintained confidentiality required. And the confidentiality requirements fall under 45 CFR 205.50. So a federal law that we need to make sure that we were in tune with. So our work group, a small subsect, did amazing work. Just really incredible teamwork to come together even on a Friday afternoon and work that out. Judge McKnight was there among the folks and get approval from the Region 10 rep that these were in fact in line with those confidentiality requirements. So I'm really proud that we've accomplished that goal. There's a couple other small tweaks. Of course, if we're going to amend the bill, we couldn't help ourselves, but clarifying a couple issues. There is on page 17 currently a reference to audio and visual recordings. We were trying to clarify that aspect, but those matters are well handled in 419A.256 subs 3 and 4, so we're just going to remove that. Also then, on page 18, we have a reference to guardians when we're talking about termination of parental rights. Well, guardians don't have their parental rights terminated, so that's superfluous language that we would like to do away with. We would, however, in that same area of the bill on page 18, want to make sure that parents can obtain a copy of the judgment terminating their parental rights. So we wanted to write that into the bill to make sure that they could get that paperwork. And then in terms of the notice requirements under the new Section 9 that lays out the provisions for how a person or entity would request records, we wanted to make sure that the attorneys of record received notice that was, they're obviously not parties to the case, but it would be crucial for them to know that somebody else was looking for those records. So we've done that as well. And just to quickly mention the application and operative date, we have kept that at September 30th, 2016, because we think folks are well aware that this date has been out there, so it would be best just to implement this new provision at the same time that older one does sunset. And, you know, I have to just mention that the Oregon Law Commission, we are only referencing and discussing sections 7, 8, 9, 11, and 12 of this bill. Those are the sections that comprise the Juvenile Court Records Work Group. So we take no position on the contents outside of that. But that does bring me to a couple of thank yous. First of all, Chair Barker, thank you very much for helping us get a vehicle and combining this bill with the other matters. And thank you, Council Newell, for coordinating those efforts that I know was a lot of work. But Judge McKnight and Chair McFarland have both come down numerous times to testify, and we thank them very much. And, you know, at the Oregon Law Commission, we enjoy a very special working relationship with Legislative Council. So thank you, Melissa Seidlick and Jessica Minifee, for all their work on this. And again, just that small subset of our work group that really, I mean, there was so much back and forth and the time that went in just to get those provisions set for OPDS and OSB. So, you know, that was a group that included Judge McKnight, Leola McKenzie, Megan Hassan, Amber Hollister at the State Bar, Susan Graby, and Carmen Brady Wright has done a great job being our conduit between Region 10 and then also Nancy Cozine. So with that, I think we can take any questions.
Any questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, Judge,
thank
for
you.
Explaining the bill. Jeff Howes and Mark McKechnie, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. I'm back again regarding this topic, juvenile sex offender registration. Last year, around this time, this committee heard House Bill 2902. I testified in opposition to House Bill 2902. That was the precursor, ultimately, to what came out in House Bill 2320 last year. After I testified, Vice Chair Olson called me and said, let's work on some amendments to 2902 and get this back on track. I eagerly did that, and with then Legislative Council Dietrich, and we put together a bunch of amendments working with my friend Mark McKechnie here to get to a place where my organization, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, could be at a minimum neutral on that bill, and we were. What that bill did in from the big picture perspective was it changed the timing of when a youth would have to register as a sex offender if the youth is adjudicated for a an incident that if it the youth were an adult would be a felony sex offense. The presumption prior to 2320 passing was that at the time of adjudication for a qualifying incident, the youth would have to register as a sex offender. What 2320 did was change that around. It said that the youth would be on supervision either through OYA or through the local juvenile department, and that during that supervision would amass treatment records, would amass polygraph records, would show his or her sincerity in treatment and his or her ability to remain crime-free. Within 6 months of the termination of that supervision, the court would hold a hearing. And at that hearing, all parties, or prior to that hearing, all parties would be granted access to all treatment records, all polygraph records, and would be able to then form an informed argument for the court about whether or not that youth should register as a sex offender moving forward. As I said, my organization was neutral on that, but I was quite proud of the work that we did to get to that point. I missed something in that bill. Mr. McKechnie and his organization caught it, and that's that because it got jammed into 2320 sort of hastily and late in the session, we missed the fact that it was no longer a requirement that a youth register as a sex offender. Or let me make that a little more clear. A youth could not be prosecuted for failing to register as a sex offender after August 12th of 2015. We alerted the governor's office. The governor wrote a signing letter which said that I would hope that this would be corrected with all due haste. And almost immediately, Mr. McKechnie, myself, Mr. Dietrich got together at my office and started crafting language to fix that. Council Newell convened a work group. It was a very collegial, very hardworking working group that managed to come up with the contents of 4074. What 4074 does now is it, I think, in terms of fundamental fairness, what 4074 does is it includes groups of youths that were not included in the original 2320 and allows them an opportunity to either not have to register or to seek relief from registration at the conclusion of their supervision. So you've got the youths that were adjudicated prior to 8/12 of 2015 and are still on supervision. You've got the youths that were adjudicated prior to 8/12 of 15 that are no longer on supervision. You've got the youths that were adjudicated after 8/12/15, and you've got the youths that were adjudicated prior to but failed to register when they were supposed to. That's the groups that are captured in the Dash 1 amendment. All of those groups, and I think that's the whole universe of youths that would find themselves in this position, now have an opportunity to either seek relief from registration or not have to register at all. I believe that the contents of 4074, particularly as amended, will rectify the problem that we sought to address and also, in terms of fairness, capture a larger group of youths that will now share in the benefits of the work that we did last year. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have, and I know Mr. McKechnie has some comments also. Thank you very much.
Right, go ahead, Mark.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. And Mr. Howes actually left me with very little to add, so I appreciate him covering the highlights of House Bill 4074. I think just to sum things up, I would say that, this bill does not change the policy in terms of what was decided in the 2015 session. It merely cleans up and helps execute the intent of what the legislature passed in 2015, recognizing that there were some additional provisions and clarity needed in terms of how different groups who are adjudicated and under the court's jurisdiction at different times would be treated. And the main thing that it clarifies is that those youth who are under the court's jurisdiction and that jurisdiction had ended prior to the effective date of the 2015 bill are essentially in the same position they always were before, that they are treated under the old law and can seek relief under the relief statute. And it's really youth who are adjudicated on or after the effective date or that were under the jurisdiction of the court who are treated under this new scheme. And having the luxury of taking another look at this bill during the interim allowed various stakeholders to think of further ways to improve the bill procedurally so that there are very clear procedures and parties are well identified and the procedures for notifying youth, notifying the courts, and then the activities that flow from those things are clearly spelled out in the bill, and I think we have a much better product as a result. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. McKechnie? Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll carry on the work session, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4116.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. This is House Bill 4116. It is brought to us today by Representative Winder. This is scheduled for a public hearing, and we do not have the financial impact statements. Providing mental and physical health care to persons incarcerated is an important part of the rehabilitation process and a significant financial burden for counties. House Bill 4116 attempts to address the concerns associated with providing health care to inmates by creating the Task Force on County Jail Inmate Health Care Coverage. This task force would investigate the financial and procedural concerns relating to the physical and mental health care services for inmates in the county jail. There's also a Dash 1 amendment brought to us by Representative Winder. The Dash 1 amendment modifies the task force to include two additional members, one from a small and rural or remote hospital, and one from a hospital that is not small or remote and receives Medicare reimbursement.
Okay, thank you. Call Sheriff Severson and Cheryl Ramirez. Thank you for hanging out all day with us. We appreciate that. Long day. Please go ahead, either one.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And I'm just here to support House Bill 4116 enthusiastically to create a task force. This will prepare us to, in our efforts to demonstrate cost savings and better health outcomes by continuing Medicaid benefits for people who are incarcerated in county jails. As you may know, the majority of people in county jails are pretrial detainees who have not yet been convicted of a crime and who do not stay very long. Most have substance use disorders and or mental illness from this group. So it's critical to continue their care while in jail or to start their care. For example, opiate treatment protocols and medication-assisted treatment. Currently, the majority of jail health care is paid by county general fund with some support from state general fund. There's no chance that this can cover all of the health care costs for jail inmates, especially for inmates with complex chronic conditions, including mental illness and substance use disorders. So we're looking forward to serving on the task force and leading the nation with other states to demonstrate the cost effectiveness in modernizing federal Medicaid policy. Thanks for the opportunity to share our comments.
Thank you. Sharon, please.
Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Tim Swenson, and I'm the Yamhill County Sheriff. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police to support the passage of House Bill 4116. I want to thank the chair and members of the committee for considering this measure today. For the last 10 years, I've worked very closely with all of our partners in Yamhill County in an effort to reduce the vulnerable population within our jails. As you're aware, this population makes up a large portion of many county jails, causing budgetary constraints on already tight operating budgets, and most importantly, does not benefit the individual who is sitting inside a jail cell. In Yamhill County, we developed a work group called the Community Crisis Response Team, known as CCRT. It consisted of representatives from the DA's office, community corrections, local police departments, jail staff, emergency department members, local crisis workers, and our Health and Human Services department. The goal is clear: keep vulnerable populations out of the jail. What I've learned over the last 10 years is that the system has failed these populations in one key arena, and that's inmate health care coverage. An individual who is eligible for OHA coverage when outside the facility now becomes ineligible because of federal prohibition. My local HHS can't even provide basic mental health crisis work to previously eligible citizens while confined to the Yamhill County Jail. The cost to provide such treatment and service now becomes the burden of the Sheriff's Office and is the burden to their budget. I met with Representative Jim Winer's staff months ago to discuss this very issue. This problem affects every county jail, and depending on the size of facility and county, is handled differently. For my county, I continue to pay my local HHS each year for crisis work and counseling within our jail. The same service they provide to their individuals when they're not in custody costs me thousands each year. I'm here today to ask for your support of this measure by creating a task force to look at this statewide issue and to develop some recommendations for solutions that will only benefit the vulnerable populations throughout the state and will provide some much-needed relief to county sheriff's office budgets. Remember, these inmates are pretrial and have not been convicted of any crimes. They deserve the same coverage they had prior to coming into our facility. Thank you for consideration of this measure. The OSSA and OASCP are committed to continuing our work in combination with other stakeholders to address this important issue.
Thank you. I apologize for butchering your name there. Hard to read it here. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. I'm not sure I have a question, but maybe you could help me. I know, I think in the 2015 session, maybe 2013, we arranged that when an inmate had to go to the hospital, they had private health insurance, we reestablished their private health insurance so that's covered. I'm intrigued with the notion of, of modernizing federal regulations. I'm not sure we can put a task force together that can change federal regulations. Is there something else you have in mind? I mean, if there's a way to do it, we should just do it. I don't think we need a task force.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I believe that it will take states looking forward and being visionary, and I think Oregon is one of those states, to push federal policy. And I think we can accomplish this by putting this in our 1115 waiver amendment to cover this population with Medicaid and show that it's cost effective, it will improve their health outcomes, and it will decrease the costs of health care. So I'm advocating for us to include this in our 11 costs of health care. So I'm advocating.